And we come to Matthew 26, verse 41. Matthew 26, verse 41. And you will recall that last week we looked at three passages in succession in what we spoke of as a comparative exegesis, in order to bring out the meaning of each passage. And the last of these was Matthew 26:41, which we only touched upon without really expounding it. But this passage of the Lord's teaching is so important that it is important for us to understand the spiritual principle that is embodied in it, enshrined in it. This is, of course, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and in a very, very vital and very profound moment of the Lord's life upon the earth, indeed in his last moments already. So Matthew 26, verse 41 tells of how the Lord Jesus prayed in the garden in an agonizing passion of prayer. And he sought a little help, if you can put it that way, a little fellowship, a little companionship from his disciples in that fearful hour. But it was not to be had. The disciples were simply unable to give him the kind of shoulder-to-shoulder help in the battle that our brother Don was mentioning in the communion. They were not able to be cohesive, if you like to put it this way. They could not stick with him. They could not stay with him. And when it came to this matter of joining him in prayer, they simply fell asleep. And maybe that is no new experience to you and to me either. That many a time you're trying to pray, and what do you discover? That next time you opened your eyes, you found yourself fast asleep. And therefore, I say this so that we don't take a condemning attitude of these three apostles as they sought to stay with the Lord Jesus in prayer, but couldn't. They couldn't make it. The reason for this is given to us in verse 41, which is the verse we will look at today. Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed. Verse 41, "Watch and pray, that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass until I drink it, thy will be done." Here the words are, the flesh is weak, the spirit is willing. The disciples were willing to try and stay with the Lord Jesus in this fearful hour. They were willing to follow him to the end. The willingness was there. It was not lacking. But the flesh was weak. The flesh prevented them from accomplishing what they sought to do. Now, in your in the lay training, you will have touched upon this matter of the flesh. And here we need to look at this vital principle perhaps a little more deeply. Because here we see the word willing. First, we need to understand this matter. The word willing is a little too weak to translate the Greek word standing here. It is much more than willing. The word actually means eager. The spirit is eager. The spirit of these apostles, the Lord concedes to them, is really eager. The fact that they could not do it was not because their spirits were unwilling to do it. The word, in fact, comes from a Greek word which is very strong, made up of two parts. The second part, thumos, expresses vehement passion, very strong feeling. And this is the idea that is there. The Lord Jesus credits them with much more than willingness. Willingness can say, okay, I'll go along. You can say, that's willing. Would you like to do it? Okay. This is sort of barely across the line, sort of barely willing to make it. No. This is not the word. The word is, the spirit is willing in the sense of being very eager. The apostles, you remember, Peter said, we will die with you. We will follow you to the end. That is not just willingness, that is eagerness. The readiness to die with him. But when it came to the crunch, it was not that the spirit was not eager to do it. The flesh was the big obstacle. So this word eager, this word expressing strong desire, is used, for example, by Paul in Romans chapter 1 and verse 15, where he says, I am eager to preach the gospel wherever it is not preached, whether it is to the Romans or to the Gentiles, wherever they may be. He is burning to get the gospel to them. That's exactly the same word in the original as we have here. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 19, you have another occurrence of this same word. It's used several times in the New Testament. And there it is the eagerness to help brothers and sisters in Jerusalem in need financially. It's not that they are just willing to help. They are really eager to help. And this gives Paul a great joy that the saints had such love and such concern for one another. And in the same way too, we find that this is a principle which is vital to understand if we are going to get anywhere in the Christian life. Because we are talking not about some philosophy. We are talking about an empirical fact. I use the word empirical here advisedly, something that we can test and experience for ourselves as true. And we are not talking about some vague theoretical ideas. We are talking about the conflict or the opposition between flesh and spirit, which is a part of our daily life, something that we experience every day. And unless we know how to overcome this problem, we will get nowhere, absolutely nowhere spiritually, because the flesh will block us all the time. Now, this happens from the very first moment you come into contact with the gospel. The moment you want to think of becoming a Christian, for example, the moment you think of becoming a Christian, there is the moment you will experience this reality that the Lord Jesus is talking about. You may have now the willingness to become a Christian, but immediately the flesh rises up and stops you. It says, don't be silly. Don't be ridiculous. Don't do such a thing. You cannot do this to me, the flesh that is. I mean, okay, go to church sometimes. That's okay. You know, sing along with the songs a bit. They have some nice songs to sing. But don't get into this business. You know, you might get hooked, you see. And this hook has a retro barb on it. You can't get off the hook anymore once you get hooked, you see. Very dangerous to become Christian. And then when you ponder what's so dangerous about it, oh, the flesh has many reasons. I mean, your friends will laugh at you. I mean, your beautiful girlfriend might leave you. And she says, what? You become religious? Forget it. This will not do it. And all this, all your prospects, I mean, maybe God will send you to preach the gospel somewhere. Oh, I don't want to be a preacher. I don't mind becoming a Christian, but the preacher is not for me, you know. So you begin to think of all the possibilities and dangers which lie ahead. And the flesh is going to remind you of every one of these things. What will your father say? What will your mother say? What will everybody else say? Oh, what will your boss say? What, you gone religious too? And what will happen to me? I mean, maybe I can't go to the movies anymore. And maybe next time I can't go to the opera when Swan Lake is being shown. Maybe I can't go to the dances my friend's going to invite me. How can I go dance as a Christian? You know, this is not done. I can't even drink coffee anymore, maybe. And this is going to be hard. Maybe my life is going to be, maybe I have to wear black suits the whole time. You know, right? So immediately the flesh thinks of every conceivable obstacle, whether it is genuine or ridiculous, whatever it may be. From the first moment that you come into contact with spiritual reality, it is simply a fact of life that there will be the conflict between the spirit and the flesh. So, as I say, it is most important to understand that the Lord is dealing with a fundamental reality here that has nothing to do with philosophy, nothing to do with were simply some hypothesis. The spiritual life, the reality of the spiritual life, is something that you can experience for yourself from the very first moment you come into contact with the gospel. When you ask, what is it that is opposing this spiritual power working in me? Ask yourself, what is it? It's very interesting. Spiritual reality is not pie in the sky. For those of us who try day by day to follow as disciples of the Lord, spiritual reality is a matter that you taste daily, all the time. Now, then think further along. The moment you think, for example, of serving the Lord, there the flesh is absolutely in arms. It is screaming and shouting by this time. I mean, this will not do. This will absolutely, okay, become a Christian, fine. Go to church, that's fine, yeah. Get baptized, okay, we can tolerate all that. But serve the Lord? What, are you out of your mind? What's going to happen to me, the flesh? This will not do at all. The battle becomes fierce to the point of raging sometimes. And then we're beginning to talk about it. The flesh says, but is it the will of God? I got you there, right? Because immediately you think, how do I know whether it's the will of God or not? Now you're all in a state of confusion. And nothing is so effective as getting you confused, because now then you can forget the thought, since you don't know how to think from there on. I've seen many a Christian come up to this point, serve the Lord, and then immediately confusion arises. Problems begin. Obstacles come. Everything comes in the way. Really remarkable. So, this is simply a reality. And I have many times sat on the side and listened to reasons given to me as to why a person didn't serve the Lord. And I made no comment. I just quietly listened and thought to myself, there the flesh has won another battle. Of course, by that time, the flesh, and by the way, I should make it clear to you that if you think the flesh comes simply in a crude manner, you have not understood. The flesh is exceedingly subtle. The flesh will approach you and use every conceivable argument, even the spiritual ones. If you have been in debate, you will know how skillful the worldly man knows how to debate. In fact, he will try to take you on your own ground, because he knows that the most successful debate, the way to deal with it, is to take you on your own ground if he can. So he will use spiritual arguments against you. Oh, yes. Even though he doesn't believe those arguments. But he will use them against you because, I mean, win is win. By fair or by foul, doesn't matter. Whether you believe the argument or not also doesn't matter. So long as you gain your point. And the flesh is like that. It does not talk about honesty. It is so long as it gains its end. It will use any argument, be it ever so spiritual. Like the one I just said. How do you know it's the will of God? And since most Christians don't know how to know the will of God, you settle the point very quickly there, because he is out of the running from that point on. And he's going to take so long to even study the principles, maybe 5 years for him, he thinks, to study how to know the will of God, that you can put him out of the race for that time. And when he gets to understanding how to know the will of God, you'll find something else to deal with him then. It is something so subtle, so remarkable. And the flesh is, we're ready to cling to any excuse. Like the case, as I think maybe some time ago I mentioned, like a person that I knew, he applied to Bible college. And he filled in the forms. And you remember what happened? He walked up to the, he struggled about this for a long time. The flesh put every opposition in the way. But the day came that he actually managed to get to filling in the form, sealing the envelope, sticking the stamp on. That was an effort. He battled the flesh all the way. And he was there on his way to post it in the letterbox. And whom should he meet but the local pastor? What are you doing? I'm putting this letter and posting it to the Bible college. Which Bible college? Oh, the one in Scotland. Oh, no, you don't want to go to Bible college? No. Oh, the pastor said don't go to Bible college. I mean, a word closer from God you couldn't get. Of course, it didn't worry him too much that this pastor was a liberal. But anyway, because so long as he's a pastor, it's a pastor, you know. And so there he goes. That was the end of the application. Finish. that he didn't need more than that. That was all the reason or excuse, whichever you like to call it, that he didn't need to go. This principle, the struggle, the battle between spirit and flesh, and remember the subtlety of the flesh, the willingness to use any excuse, spiritual or carnal, whichever is more effective on you, it will use. Now, the word here, weak, translated weak, the spirit is eager, perhaps. In some cases, it's not even eager, in which case, there's no contest. I see many Christians where the spirit is not even eager. So really, the spiritual battle is already resolved before it started. The defeat has already been guaranteed from the beginning. But here the Lord is speaking to the apostles, committed people, people who are committed to following the Lord right to the end. Yes, Peter said, I will die with you. And he meant it. No one doubts that he meant it, even though he chickened, got a bit chicken in the end. I mean, when you see all those swords and all those torches, I mean, to say, I will die with you in this building here is no problem. I mean, there's no. But when you actually see the gleam of the swords and the tips of the spears shining in the light of the torches at night, what did I say the other time? You speak a little more softly by then. He is speaking to people as committed as that, indeed willing. But even there, with all that willingness, notice that, they couldn't make it. Couldn't make it. Why? The flesh is weak. What does this word weak mean? This word, the Greek word, basically is made up of two parts. And the main part is the word for strength. And the other part is the word for no strength. That is, without strength. That's the word, what the word literally means. Weak, being deprived of strength. Now this word in the Bible is very frequent. It is used very, very often. In the New Testament, it is used again and again of physical illness. Time and again, it is used of physical illness. Because when are you weak? When you are ill. You are without strength. As you know, you are hit by a fever and suddenly your legs go weak. Like Ealing this week came home from school and she said to me, my legs are so weak. She had trouble standing up. She just wanted to sit down, which is very unlike her, of course. Very hard usually to keep her in a seat. But this time she was really without strength. And this is the word here, because she was running a fever. And that is why this word is constantly used to refer to illness. In Acts chapter 4, verse 9, for example, it refers quite specifically to a cripple, a person who was born lame or crippled from birth. And you remember this was the person that John healed outside, Peter and John healed outside the gate of the temple, the gate called Beautiful. And this, the related word to this, the verb form and the noun form, are used five times in John 11 of Lazarus. You remember Lazarus was sick and died? And this word is used five times of his illness, of which he died. So the body is weak because of illness, but the flesh is weak because of what? The flesh is weak, Paul tells us in Romans, because of sin. In Romans chapter 5, verse 6, the non-Christian state of existence is described as weakness. This is very interesting. In Romans 5, 6, Paul says that while we were still weak, notice that word, Christ died for us. What do you mean we were still weak? When we were in that position, spiritually, where sin had dominion over us, and therefore the flesh weakened by sin, was unable to help us. We could not save ourselves. We were weak. That is vital to understand. That is why any suggestion of a salvation by works is, of course, utterly ridiculous. Because in order to save yourself by works, you have to be strong. But by definition, we are weak. Paul says, while we were still weak, when we were non-Christians, that is, Christ already died for us then. So this weakness is the result and the effect of sin dwelling in the flesh. Now, this point is so important, in fact, in the scriptures, that in fact it is the key to the whole book of Romans. This is what the whole book of Romans is about. The book of Romans is about this problem of the willingness of the spirit on the one hand and the weakness of the flesh on the other. But we shall look at that more later on. Right now we want to look carefully at this word weak. In Hebrews chapter 7 verse 28, the writer says that the high priests were subject to weakness. What does that mean? That the high priest was in poor health? Or that he got sick easily? No, of course not. What it means is that the high priest was weak because he, like everyone else, was subject to sin. Unlike the Lord Jesus, he could not win the battle against sin. He was weak. He could not triumph in his own strength. He was sharing the weakness of all mankind, the bondage to sin. And that is the whole point of Hebrews, of course. The whole point that the law could not help us to win the battle against sin. The law could define sin, but could not help us to win the battle against it. Now, the remarkable thing is, of course, I wonder that whether you are understanding even what I'm saying. Because if you have trouble understanding what I'm saying, it shows that the flesh is already very effective in your life. Why? Because the flesh makes spiritual things very hard for us to understand. You see, that is why I said, understanding spiritual things has nothing to do with intelligence as such. A person may be extremely intelligent, but he has great difficulty understanding spiritual things. Why? Because the flesh, working within him, constantly opposing his spiritual understanding, virtually neutralizes his ability to understand spiritual things. He cannot function. This flesh so weakens us that it neutralizes us. It makes us ineffective, not only in doing spiritual things, but even in understanding spiritual things. And I'm sure many people here are very intelligent, but you will find many times when you study the Bible, you find it very hard to understand what's being said. Yet you look at the language, and the language is quite simple. The grammar is easy, but the meaning you cannot grasp. Not because you are unintelligent. It is because you have not the spiritual capacity for understanding it. And you find that as you mature spiritually, you understand things that you didn't understand before with great ease. And you wonder why you couldn't understand it before. And now you find it so easy to understand. Did you get more intelligent as you went along in the Christian life? Well, maybe that happens too. I don't know. What really happens is that as the flesh weakens, that is to say, as the flesh itself is being brought under control, your spiritual understanding becomes clearer and sharper all the time. I think I am no more intelligent now than I was when I first became a Christian. But today, I can understand many things that at that time I found impossible to grasp. It was so high and far beyond. I had no idea what it meant. Yet today, as I look over it, I find it that I can understand it at a glance. It is so plain, so clear. Not because I got any more intelligent, but as it is that as we went on in the battle against the flesh, as the flesh was brought more and more under control, it was no longer so effective to hinder my spiritual understanding. And you will find often that when you find something very hard to understand, you also find the same problem with the apostles here. Very hard to keep awake. You see, I found many people when they first came to the church, they found it hard to keep awake. You see, why? Because it's so hard to understand. What is he talking about? It's easier to understand physics than to understand what this guy is talking about. It's easier to understand chemistry. What is he talking about? But, of course, your increase of knowledge helps your understanding. Increase of knowledge certainly helps your understanding. But there are certain things which even the increase of knowledge will not help. Many things have to do with background knowledge, background material. But there is an aspect of spiritual truth that depends upon insight. And that insight cannot come to you so long as the flesh has control of your thoughts. That is what is a carnal Christian. The Bible speaks of carnal Christians. A carnal Christian is somebody whose mind is still dominated by the old fleshly way of thinking, a non-spiritual way of thinking. That makes things, spiritual things, very hard to understand. I think of all the young people in China, and we were talking with a friend last week, and I was asking about this question of situation in China. I was wondering to what extent this fleshly teaching, this materialistic, carnal teaching, has made it more difficult, maybe even impossible for some, to understand spiritual things anymore. You're indoctrinated since childhood in materialism, so much so that your mind is completely dominated by the flesh, unable to think spiritual things at all. This is the kind of situation that we find ourselves, that as non-Christians, all of us are dominated by the flesh to a greater or lesser extent, and mostly to a greater extent. So do you find the message hard to understand? Nothing difficult about that. Paul says in Romans chapter 6, verse 19, to the Romans. In chapter 6, 19 of Romans, he says, I speak in simplified terms because of your weakness. Your weakness. He's speaking to the Roman Christians, and the Roman Christians are weak. You see, I have to speak more simply to you because I realize your weakness. He realizes that all Christians are subject to this problem of understanding spiritual truth. And Paul says, therefore, he uses human terms because of their difficulty to understand. And the Greek word there is weakness. Now, this being the case, we must look at this problem very closely. Now, Paul addresses two books, virtually, to dealing with this question. Romans, as I mentioned, is one of these, and the word flesh and spirit occur constantly in Romans, and particularly in Romans chapter 7 and chapter 8. There is, at the very heart of the letter, he comes to this point and deals very specifically with it. Again, in Galatians, he deals with this matter very intensely. For example, it's interesting to note statistically that the word flesh occurs 18 times in Galatians, and the word spirit also occurs 18 times in Galatians. There, and this is a very high percentage compared to everywhere, all the other books in the New Testament. But as we look at this matter, the question is, how can we overcome the problem of the flesh? Your spirit may be very eager, and especially you've been, say, through the lay training, you've got a glimpse of some spiritual truth and insight. Some fire may be burning in your heart. You have an eagerness. But unless you understand this spiritual principle involved here, you will be put out of effectiveness for the rest of your Christian life. Every Christian, including the Apostle Paul, starts out with the same situation. He has not one bit of advantage over us. But what made an Apostle Paul an Apostle Paul? What made him the spiritual giant that he is? And what makes most Christians so average, so ordinary, so powerless? Do you think that Paul was born somehow spiritually with some certain advantages? Not at all. He himself describes his own problem in Romans chapter 7. The good that I would, I cannot do. And the evil that I would not do, that I find myself doing. I am defeated constantly, Paul says. I know from my own experience this terrible battle inside of me between the spirit and the flesh. Paul has exactly the same problem. So what makes him a spiritual giant? Because he overcame by the grace of God, the flesh. I can do all things, he says. I wonder how many Christians dare to say that. I can do all things, he says in Philippians chapter 4, through him that strengthens me. Notice the word strengthens against the weakness. The power of God was so effective in Paul, so triumphant in Paul, that he had the confidence that there was nothing impossible for him to do. The flesh was brought so completely under control. He broke the power of the flesh, you could say, by the Spirit of God in his life. And it is this secret that he is sharing in Romans chapter 8. He has not kept the secret to himself. He tells us how he does it. And that whole secret is there expounded in Romans 8. He says that by the Spirit, living under the control of the Spirit, he is able to break the power of the flesh and able to accomplish all that needs accomplishing. Now, he could do it. We can do it too. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 29, that I like to read so often, he says there that he strives with all the might, all the power that God mightily inspires in me. Oh, that's just fantastic. All the might which he inspires in me. No wonder that this apostle could shake the whole Gentile world. Because God's power was flowing unhindered through his life. God can take any one of us here, all of us spiritual nobodies. He can take any one of us, and he can make of us channels of that power, release it into the world. If only we have not only the willingness, not only the eagerness, but also that we know how to let the flesh and its weakness be dealt with. And this is precisely what I'm concerned to share with. Now, we cannot cover everything in this one session. But what we aim to do is to look at some very vital principles here, which if we implement through the power of the Spirit, living under the control of the Spirit, we will be able to implement fully. Because it is urgent that in this generation, God's power be again manifested to the world. You know, what grieves my heart all the time is when I look at the church and all I see is the flesh. I don't see the Spirit. I see the flesh. Do you? What do you see when you look at the church? And when I say church, I am not speaking against others. I am part of the church. I want to attack myself. I want to condemn myself if through this self-condemnation others might be saved. What do people see in us? The flesh. All we want, as I said last week, is money to build this and that. What do we need all this for? We claim that we need this and we need that. We need a nicer building, a new facility. We need this and that. What do we need? Did the Lord Jesus need it? Did the apostles need it? Did they build anything? Nothing. For them, they needed none of these things. And we need it all. We say to ourselves, we need it. All the time, we need money for missions. And where are the people in the missions? Who are these people being sent to the missions? I am willing to give money to missions anytime. But I want to know, who are these people out there? Are they making the right sort of disciples? Are they making the right sort of converts? What kind of Christians are they making? The kind who says, yes, I become Christian, just give me the bowl of rice and I'm there. What sort of Christians are you making? I'm not going to support this kind of thing. And what has happened is everywhere you see is the way the flesh. Look inside the church and you see conflict in the church. If you ask, what is the root of that conflict? Again, it's the flesh. All the time, flesh. I went to Calgary recently, and what do I discover? Churches are all in conflict with one another over there. It's a disgrace. Why? Flesh. It's the flesh in the church everywhere. What about the pastor? The pastor wants more pay. He meets the trustees, the board of trustees, and says, pay is not good here. If you don't raise my pay, there's another church over there that's going to give me more. So come on, you make up your mind. You raise the pay or I go, huh? I mean, men of God also have to live, huh? I mean, you got to think about that. And so what I heard the other day, just in Calgary, and I won't mention which church, it doesn't matter which church, because these things, the pastor,